Tokyo Podcast episode number 29.
Hey everybody, I'm back in Japan and I'm really excited to be back. On this show, I'm going to talk to YouTube creator Mr. Hiko Simon about what it's like to be a foreigner living in Japan. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and I am very pleased to say that I am now back in Japan. For the past month, I was on holiday in my home country of Vancouver, Canada, and it's been a while since I've actually been home. I left Canada in 2007, and I've been, since then I've lived in various countries. I was living in Europe for a while, and I was living in Thailand for a while, and now I'm living in Japan. So it was the first time that I've been back since I left, and it was a rather interesting experience for me because going back, I felt almost like a tourist in my own town. Some of it was very familiar to me, but some of it was all new, you know? And so it got me thinking about what it's like to be a foreigner in a new country. For many people, that's kind of a scary concept, but actually if you do it long enough, like I have, it becomes kind of normal. And then to go back to where everything is familiar, that actually feels kind of strange. So on today's show, I wanted to talk to a gentleman who goes by the name Hiko Simon, and he is the host of an extremely popular YouTube channel. Hiko's channel has over 26,000 subscribers. His videos have millions of views on them, and Hiko covers all sorts of things about life here in Japan. He speaks fluent Japanese, he's been here for many years, and he provides a very valuable insight into foreigner life here in Japan. So me being kind of a foreigner back in my own country and being a foreigner in many other countries, I thought it would be kind of interesting to hear what Hiko Simon has to say about what it's like to be a foreigner here in Japan. But first, before we get to Hiko Simon, I wanted to talk about three things that I kind of really struck me about being back in Japan. Being back in Canada. The first thing was how easy everything was to do. Now, this is going to sound a bit strange to those of you who've never left your home country, but for those of you who are used to living as a foreigner in another country, you know that some of the simplest things back in your home country can be mind-numbingly, excruciatingly painful experiences in a new country. Now, I understand that a lot of the problems that I've had living in new countries and even living in Japan here could be solved by speaking fluent Nihongo. However, that hasn't quite happened yet, so I am still struggling through dealing with the language issues. Now, my good friend Ashley Thompson, who runs the website Surviving in Japan, recently wrote an article about, you know, some of the survival tactics that she uses to get by here in Japan. And this really got me thinking about how easy everything was for me back in Canada. I was able to go to the bank, and I was able to get new credit cards, and I was able to close some accounts and redirect some mail. And all those things here in Japan would have involved lots of hand signals, lots of electronic dictionaries, online searches, some frustration, multiple trips to and from the bank, all mostly due to my language inability to speak Japanese. But back in Canada, because you know everything is in English, I was really surprised how easy everything was to do again. Because I've been a foreigner for so long, it's become kind of normal for me to expect everything to be a bit of a challenge. And so when I was able to kind of accomplish everything that I needed to do rather quickly without any issues, and everyone understood what I said, it was a rather interesting experience for me. that was the first thing that kind of struck me, was just being around English-speaking people and an English environment again, and how easy everything made it, which, you know, just absolutely goes to reinforce what I believe in, that whenever you move to a new country, the first thing you have to do is learn the language. It just makes everything so simple. Even if you move to a country like Thailand that has a large, you know, English-speaking population, and you can easily live there without speaking any Thai, if you can speak the language, it does make things a whole lot easier. And I really, you know, really realized that when I'm back to Canada, because I could do anything I wanted instantly because I could speak the language. And it was really strange, actually, at first, because when I arrived and I, you know, I met some friends and we went to a local shopping mall just to get some food, it was weird for me to be able to read everything. I was just struck by how I could read everything. I could read the signs on the menu. I could read, you know, the signage on the doors and everything. Because, you know, for the past 5 years, I haven't lived in a country where English was prominently displayed. It was always, you know, the second or third language displayed. So it was the first thing that really struck me was that I could read and understand everything. And also I could understand what everybody else was saying around me. I've been so used to not being able to, you know, just literally tune everybody out because I didn't understand what everyone was saying around me. It was strange to suddenly hear and understand what everything was being said around me. And I actually had to be a bit careful about what I said myself. An interview I did with a gentleman who goes by Unrested. If you look in my archives, you'll see an interview I did with Unrested, who's from Florida. He talked about this a little bit in our interview as well, that when he went back to America, he had to be careful what he said. And I didn't really get it until I recently went back to Canada. And I realized that I also had to be careful what I said, because everybody else around me could understand me. This is kind of convenient when you live in a foreign country that many people don't speak English. I could communicate with people in English and not worry that others around me would understand what I'm saying. But back in Canada, I couldn't quite do that. So that was a kind of an interesting experience, to be back in an English-speaking country again and be able to understand and read everything. The second thing that really kind of surprised me was being able to see old friends again. In the day and age of Facebook and Twitter and all these other kind of technology that allows us to communicate, when I originally left Vancouver, I didn't really think about would I miss my friends or family, anyone back home, because even back home, most of the time I would talk to them on Facebook anyways. But going back this time now, I was really struck by how much fun it was to be able to hang out with old group of friends again. And this is something that I've heard from other expats that they miss, is that when you come to a new country, you might make some new friends in that country that you're living in, but typically they won't be the same as the friends you made back home. You know, they won't get the Seinfeld joke that you made, or the reference to a funny movie that came out in your home country a long time ago. So it was kind of nice to be able to sit down with my friends and go to a local bar and drink some beers and actually watch a hockey game at normal time, not getting up at 3 a.m. to watch some crappy stream on my computer. But it was just nice to be able to hang out with all my friends again and, you know, what we say, shoot the shit in English, you know, like just be able to hang out and talk about anything we want and not have that technology in the way. So I kind of really realized how important it is to kind of maintain that friendship with people and try to build new ones in real life and not just on Facebook, you know. The third thing that really kind of struck me was just the sheer number of options of food and everything that we have in Canada. And I think America is the same way as well. For example, I really like bread. Of course, I'm, you know, from North America, I love bread, right? And in Thailand, I was very fortunate that I had a friend of mine who ran a custom bakery service. I don't know how you call it, but he was this guy who loved making these fancy European style bread. So he would make these, all these like custom handmade bread. Is that how you call bread? Handmade bread? I don't know. But he would make this bread every morning, and he would deliver it to everybody who would order it. So every day I would have like fresh, new European style bread delivered to my house. And I absolutely loved it. Because Bangkok, like Japan, I've noticed, they don't seem to have a very wide selection of bread. Most of it is that white styrofoam looking sandwich bread, which I really don't like at all. So it was really strange for me when I first went into a grocery store back in Canada and to see this huge wall of bread. And not only was bread, but they had like bagels and they had like French bread and they had like all these different types of bread just there. And also with cheese. You know, Tokyo and Bangkok are kind of the same in that cheese is rather expensive here and rather limited, rather small. You know, you get these little tiny slices that are really expensive. Whereas back in Canada, you can get a huge block of cheese for, you know, less than like $5, less than 500 yen. So I was really struck by just the massive selection of everything that they have, especially food-wise, back in Canada. It was kind of fun for me to go back and eat all that, you know, Canadian food again and not have to kind of struggle to find it or anything like that. So it was a really interesting experience for me to be back in my home country and to be able to experience all these Canadian things that back then I didn't even think about, you know. It was fun to be kind of a tourist back in my home country. And the thing that I really kind of took away from all that, though, was that how little changes in everyday people's lives. For example, when I went back to my old neighborhood, I saw the same homeless beggar outside my apartment that I saw last time I was in Vancouver. The same guy in the same spot. And I was really surprised to see the same guy again. I don't think he remembered me, but I was also struck by some of the friends that I talked to, how they were kind of doing the same thing. Some of the people that I talked to had been doing the same thing since high school. That was over 20 years ago. And so it really kind of makes me realize that I think as humans, we want change, but we're afraid of change. But you really don't realize, I think, until you kind of leave how consistent your life can get. You know, if I think we're all kind of working away and we're kind of hoping that something happens to improve our lives, but unless we make some dramatic steps to make those changes happen, I really feel that the changes that we want aren't going to happen. And that if you're kind of planning this gradual, you know, steps to success, it's going to take a lot longer than you anticipate. I'm really kind of glad that, like, I feel like in the fast 5 years since I left Canada, that I've experienced so much more than the 20-30 years that I spent in Canada, and I'm so happy that I made that jump. Now the thought of going back to a normal everyday average life back in Canada or anywhere seems strange to me. When I first left Canada, it felt strange to be in this kind of uncertain life where I didn't know where my income was coming from and I didn't know where I was living. I didn't know the language and all that kind of stuff. But now that all feels quite normal to me. And I really like it because it's constantly pushing change into my life. For example, when I came back to Japan, I found out that I have to change my apartment. My landlord informed me that he's upgrading the building for earthquake code. And so as much as I don't want to, because I love my apartment, I have 30 days to find a new one. And so those are a little bit of unwelcome change, but I'm really happy that I left and I put myself in a situation where I am forcing new change into my life all the time, because I always feel that with all that change comes opportunity. And I felt kind of bad for some of my friends that I, you know, met back in Canada who seemed envious of what I'm doing, but were stuck in a rut and in the same job, same situation. Nothing had changed for them in the last 20 years or last 10 years or whenever the last time I saw them. So I really kind of encourage anyone who's listening to this that if you are thinking about making some change in your life, and you're you're planning on doing it gradually, my suggestion to you would be to do it quickly. Make a dramatic change. Force change into your life. Force yourself to deal with it. And I think that you will see tremendous results as a result of that. On today's show, I'm talking to a gentleman who goes by the name Hiko Simon, and he has a very well-known YouTube channel. He makes videos both in English and Japanese, and to date, his videos have been viewed by over 2 million people. He joins us today to talk about what it's like to be a gaijin in Japan. Can gaijin ever be fully accepted into Japanese culture? And actually, what's it like to be Japanese in Japan? Hey, Hiko, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
No worries.
I didn't realize I had 2 million views. Wow.
Yeah, 2.3 million.
Crikey. Yeah.
27,000, I think, subscribers.
Although that's probably going to change in the next couple of days because YouTube's changing their methodology to cut out all dead channels. So I'm expecting to go down to about 3,000 probably.
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't know, but it's going to crash. I don't care. It's all right.
It's funny to read the people who are complaining about it because, you know, those are the ones whose subscriber base. Those are the ones who, you know, get all their friends to create new accounts and subscribe. And
There's a lot of people who do very sneaky things to boost their accounts. So, yeah, it will be funny seeing all of them get shown up. But hopefully I won't be one of them.
Hopefully you won't go down.
I don't care that much.
Can you give the audience a quick background on yourself? Maybe if they're not familiar with your channel, what brought you to Japan? How long have you been here? And what made you start your YouTube channel?
Right. The short version, I've been in Japan 13 and a half years. I'm originally from New Zealand, although being here this long has kind of made my accent turn into like a South African, Australian, New Zealand hybrid. nobody knows where I'm from anymore. I spent a long time working in Japanese companies, and I spent a long time trying to have a very deep Japanese experience, and then I switched to my current job, which is in an American company, although I'm just about to make a jump back into what, for intents and purposes, will be a Japanese company in Japan. And in terms of YouTube, when I found that I was working a lot and I didn't have a lot of time for the kind of outdoor, more healthy hobbies that I always had, but I was able to sit at my desk. I got into vlogging just kind of out of fun, just to see what, you know, see if I could do it, because I enjoyed watching other vloggers on YouTube, and it kind of stuck. Some people liked some of my videos, and I caught the bug, and so I've been vlogging for about 3 years now, and that slowly built up over time. But the principle of my videos is that I basically, me personally, what I like to do is I like to try to reach out to both the Japanese and the English audience at the same time. So in order to do that, I do my vlogs in Japanese, but with English subtitles, basically because it's much easier to subtitle in English what I'm saying in Japanese than it is to subtitle in Japanese what I say in English. But I try to keep them short. I try to talk about kind of cross-cultural topics, topics that I think would be of interest both to foreigners in Japan and Japanese people. So that's kind of the theme that I've stuck to. And probably over the last year, I've really gotten into blogging and Twitter a little bit more as well. I enjoy writing, and it's a lot easier to write blogs when you push for time, obviously, than it is to set up a whole recording setup. So
what brought you to Japan originally?
If you know New Zealanders, New Zealanders have this thing called the OE, the Overseas Experience, that basically every New Zealander, when they finish either high school or college, leaves the country, every single one. And we all plan to go somewhere. Most end up in the UK or in Australia. I grew up in Singapore for a time, in Southeast Asia. My dad was in the army there, so I lived in Chinese neighborhoods, so I always had an interest in Asian cultures. And because of all the tourism and the trade that New Zealand does with Japan, they're very big on pushing Japanese language. So I studied Japanese language in school from when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
I did a homestay in Fukuoka when I was 15.
Right.
And it was really the homestay that confirmed it. I was more interested in Chinese culture originally from being in Singapore. But being in Fukuoka and just loving experiencing Japan, my decision was that, yeah, when I go through university and I finish all that, I'm going to go and try to work in Japan. So I pretty much planned it like back when I was 16 or 15 that I was going to come and live here. And I did it pretty much to plan. I came over straight after I graduated. And I've been living here and working here ever since.
Yeah, that's one thing I really enjoy about your YouTube channels is that you provide kind of an in-depth look at Japanese culture. There's certainly a lot of YouTubers making videos about their experience, their daily life here. Mm. You know, hey, check out this new train that I found. And, wow, look at these crazy vending machines. And wow, all this manga. But there's not as many who are providing kind of a look inside the cultural aspect of it. And that's something that I really enjoyed. I enjoyed watching your videos before I came here.
Yeah.
Kind of get an idea of what it's like to live in Japan.
Yeah, my philosophy is I use the pattern strategy, which is, you know, the always attack the enemy where they ain't. Yeah. Always go try to find where people aren't doing things that you're interested in and fill those. So I don't try to compete with the just arrived in Japan, you know, look at these tourist site kind of vlogs, of which there are many very, very good ones that I couldn't compete with. But yeah, what I can bring to the table that I think I can do well that other people don't seem to do very much is kind of more an intermediate to advanced level discussion of culture, and more at people who are already living here or who have a pretty decent level of familiarity with Japanese. And yeah, it's nice to talk at a little bit of a higher level, and to see all the feedback and the great conversations that happen back, not just from foreigners, but from Japanese people who get involved in the conversations when you do it that way. So yeah, I kind of do my own thing, but I like how it comes out.
What's something that something about Japanese culture that in your view, to you, has changed since you first got here? Like, so for example, like when you first got here, you thought this, but now you've been here 13 years, you realize, oh, maybe that wasn't the way it is.
Wow. I mean, just about everything. I mean, honestly, over 13 years, what I can tell you is that every person, no matter how unique, and believe me, nobody has tried harder than me to have a unique experience of Japan. But it's funny, when you get together with other old-timers and you sit down with a beer after like everyone's been here for like 6 or 7 years,
right,
and you compare experiences, you realize that pretty much, especially through the first 3 to 5 years, everyone goes through pretty much the same waves of exhilaration and depression and frustration and, you know, all these kinds of phases that people go through.
Right.
So, I mean, Japan has changed so much in that time. I guess the biggest hurdle that I had to cross psychologically about, especially with working for Japanese people, is coming to terms with, I read a lot about Japanese society. I really studied up and I read a lot about Japan. I was very interested in Japanese politics and Japanese society and kind of social issues and all this kind of stuff. I came to Japan with all this kind of energy and all these ideas of, you know, these problems need to be fixed and this is wrong and this needs to be, you know, like, I think it's how we study in the West. We study, you know, we foster critical thinking and we try to look at everything through a critical perspective.
Right.
And what I had the biggest trouble getting my head around was the fact that Japanese are really, really put off by criticism. Like, they'll shut down and disengage. And in order to, so you, you try to have an interesting discussion with somebody, and the moment you say something negative, they'll completely shut down the conversation, and you cease being able to have those conversations. So what I learned was, and it took me a long time to learn this, but you learn to kind of constructively engage people, like even when you're disagreeing with them and you're trying to change their mind about something. You phrase everything in terms of agreeing with them. It's the consensus. It's the idea of consensus building as opposed to confrontation.
Right.
And to wrap my head around that, like, I spent all these years. What used to kill me was this thing that everyone would, you know, like, whenever you'd say to someone, you know, isn't this terrible that the trains don't run at night, or isn't it terrible that they used to turn off the ATMs when the banks closed at 4 p.m. so you couldn't take out money anytime,
right,
or all these kind of, you know, like, stupid issues that make no sense. And you'd ask a Japanese person about it, all that they would say is shogunai. You know, it can't be helped.
Right.
And so many people, it used to kill me as well, that, you know, the shogunai is just an excuse for, you know, just being passive and not doing anything to fix anything.
Right.
But I must admit, I've become totally like that myself now. but learning to mellow out and just realize what you can change and what you can't change, and not get worked up about things that you can't change. It's kind of the way that the society works here, that everything kind of works with so many people and so much pressure and everything.
Right, right.
So the biggest transition I've gone through is just understanding how Japanese kind of cope with all the bullshit, I guess. The whole shogunai, I think. It's not exactly like Mai Pen Rai in Thailand.
Right.
It's not that laid back. But it's just an acknowledgement that it's a waste of energy trying to, you know, yeah, but so what?
Yeah.
It's that kind of a thing. And so, yeah, you know, and the idea of trying to reshape my own thinking to be positive in terms of how you address problems rather than, you know, being critical, trying to be critical all the time.
Right.
And it actually takes a lot more intelligence, I think, to be constructive and positive when having a discussion. It's much easier to tear things down and be negative. You know, I think a lot of Westerners make the mistake of thinking that being critical is showing intelligence. But I think it's pretty easy to be critical and negative and point stuff out. It's really hard to actually, you know, point out a problem, but also show an understanding of why the problem exists and propose alternatives to it at the same time. That takes a lot more brain work.
I think also, too, is I remember when we were discussing about the Japanese rice issue and how they subsidize the rice. And, you know, to our Western thinking, it seems like such a non-productive law, you know, because it raises the price of rice. And, you know, especially countries like New Zealand, you know, we encourage free trade a lot. So, but, you know, like we talked about is that you can be right in both countries. And for New Zealand, the open trade is great. But for Japan, it also works for them.
Well, that's absolutely true. In fact, no, absolutely, absolutely. And it's exactly like coming from New Zealand, we have no subsidies, no tariffs, no protection of anything. And so I came out of New Zealand, you know, as a lot of New Zealanders are from my age, my generation, being very pro-free trade and very everybody else should be like us and, you know, no tariffs. And particularly with Japanese rice, the fact that rice costs more than 20 times more in Japan than it does in New Zealand for the same varieties of rice.
Right.
It always kind of, I came here very strongly of the mind that, you know, these were problems that Japan had to fix. But yes, it's partly, this happens with migrants, I think, in most countries, that because you're quite often put in the position of defending the country against, you know, against other foreigners or being asked to explain it, I think over time you actually become in a way more strongly nationalistic towards your adopted country than even many local people are. So maybe it's partly that, but I do with rice, for example. Yeah, I no longer see rice as being a free trade issue. The most instructive thing about, and again, it's a matter of understanding why Japan subsidizes rice. I mean, of course, it subsidizes and protects all its, you know, all its agricultural industries, and its farmers. But with rice in particular, it's a national security issue, and this is the reason that, you know, the last time that Japan ran out of food, you know, it went and invaded China.
Right.
And this is why China, you know, which would have the most to gain from Japan opening its rice market, doesn't complain loudly about Japan protecting its rice market. You know, they're quite happy for Japan to have expensive rice,
right,
and leave them alone. And they buy, you know, every other vegetable from China. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have totally said Japan should just, you know, come in with no tariffs or no exceptions in any way and be totally free trade. But I kind of, yeah, I must admit, I kind of accept the rationale now for a lot of the protections that Japan has. Not all of them. But yeah, like rice, for example, absolutely, I've kind of come around very much to agree with the Japanese way of thinking on that particular issue. So yeah, that happens over time.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny how being an expat, you kind of get this feeling that you can be right in, like both people can be right, but disagree on the subject, you know, you don't really experience that back in your home country, because in your home country, if you're talking to your native friends, you usually agree on what you guys are talking about. But it's funny when you're an expat, you can be here in Japan and you can both agree that for New Zealand, this is great and it works.
Yeah.
And for Japan, this is great and it works. It's two contradictory ideologies, but they're both correct.
I'll give you a great example of this as well. And this is it. And this is actually what I still love about Japan, because it challenges you to look at your own value sets and to realize, are these just values that I have that I take for granted and never question, or are these actually valid for some reason? And it actually causes you to dig a bit deeper between the values that, you know, into the values that you, when you grow up in a particular culture, you tend to accept all the norms without really thinking very hard about them.
Right.
And a great example of this is treatment of fat people.
Right.
In Japan, you know, almost as a greeting, you might put on like 2 or 3 pounds, you know, a kilo or two. And they'll say almost as the greeting, a Japanese person says, "Hey, you put on weight." You know, it's like totally normal to a guy or a girl, like, to talk about weight and adding even just a little bit of weight and say, "Hey, you got a little bit fat over Christmas." You know, like it's the first greeting you'll say in the new year. Whereas, of course, in New Zealand and Australia, you know, that's taking your life into your hands, talking about someone else's weight.
Especially to a woman.
Especially to a woman, oh, you know. What is it? I mean, when I was told that by my Japanese friends, when I first came to Japan, I was like, well, what do you care? I'm a guy. You know, I had the idea like guys are allowed to be kind of fat anyway, right?
Right.
But yeah, Japanese is like, so I totally couldn't even understand that they were saying it to me, and I was kind of, you know, offended and put out by it. But when you think about it, you know, I mean, part of it, it's not just a healthy diet. You know, Japanese pay attention to their bodies, and they, you know, they consider keeping their weight, you know, in check as part of their, you know, general health, and it's part of why I think they get to live so long.
Right.
Whereas the fact that we've got this huge taboo against pointing out that someone's put on weight might have something to do with why Australia recently overtook America as, you know, I think now they're now like the fattest large country in the world, and we have all these obesity and, you know, child diabetes epidemics and so on. So, maybe, you know, when you look at it in the context of the kind of health consequences, I think we have such a strong fear that we're going to psychologically scar people into becoming anorexic.
Right.
If we point out their weight, that we're accepting this, you know, huge health epidemic and all these problems of associated with obesity instead. So it's funny, like, at first it kind of put me out being in Japan, but I've really come around to accepting that that's a much better, it's much better to be able to talk openly about weight than to have this taboo against it like we have.
You know what it is? Because they do so much damn walking here that if you gain weight, they think you're not walking and working as hard.
Although, well... within Tokyo, you walk a lot. Although, you know, you go like an hour out of Tokyo or Osaka or Nagoya, everybody's in cars in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
So there is that. But,
oh, okay.
But there is another thing which I've seen. I mean, there is actually, partly because fat people are kind of so rare here, relatively speaking.
Right.
I remember my old boss at the last Japanese company I worked at, we met a manager from an American company who was a big guy.
Yeah.
And he was saying, like, and this isn't true for all Japanese people, this is more his prejudice, but I've heard it said by other people as well, that there's a view that a manager who's overweight has no right to be a manager. If he can't manage himself, he has no right to manage other people.
Right.
He literally leaned across and said that to me. It's like jikokanri. He's got no self-control.
Right.
He can't, no self-management skills if he lets himself get that fat.
Right.
Which is wrong. I know some very smart and very well-organized, very fat people.
Right.
In my current job, but it's, yeah, there is this whole perception of being a, you know, a slob basically if you're fat here, which I don't know. I mean, I think in the end of the day, it's better to be healthy and to not have it as an issue if you can help it.
Right. And also, like you said too, it's better to have it kind of more open. Do you find that Japanese people are a little bit more forward and a little bit more direct in certain things like that compared to, say, Westerners?
I mean, the big two are, in my experience, the obvious ones. Generally, like with anyone who will be open talking about fatness, and I think with close friends, obviously Japanese are a lot more open about sex, I think, generally.
More open about sex?
Yeah, not publicly, not like with strangers, but with, like, for example, people who join my company at the same time, my doki or like my circle of friends. I don't know, Japan never had Christian guilt about sex. They never had that concept. They artificially tried to bring it in during the Meiji period when they imported the Prussian and Victorian legal codes, and that outlawed prostitution and outlawed kind of nudity and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So they artificially kind of imposed it by, you know, photocopying the Victorian legal system, but they never actually internalized those kind of values. So in my experience talking with Japanese friends, you know, I guess I'm not so shocked by it now, but yeah, Japanese tend to talk very, very openly about that kind of stuff in ways that I never experienced, at least back in New Zealand, even with close friends back there.
Wow, I never realized that. I haven't experienced that part yet.
yeah. Well, it's not always the case, but yeah, with Japanese girls and but especially with Japanese guys, you know, man,
right.
there's no subject that cannot be broached in that regard. And they talk about it like mowing the lawn.
I mean,
so again, there was another cultural adjustment for me getting comfortable. It's one of those things. I rationalized it. Why should we be so hung up about talking about that kind of stuff? You know, it kind of doesn't make sense that we can't talk about it.
What subjects are Japanese people a little bit more reserved about talking, even in private?
Politics, religion, sex publicly. You know, but the big ones are, I mean, as they are everywhere: sex, politics, religion,
right?
And but politics is a real big one that you need to be really, really careful of in Japan, and it's another one which a lot of foreigners, it's a trap hole because, you know, you'll have a lot of foreigners who'll never talk about someone being fat, or they'll never talk about what techniques they use for when they have sex with other people, but they'll quite happily talk about, oh, those bloody, you know,
Republicans or
those Republicans or the Democrats are ruining the country, right. Or, you know, how about that, you know, Prime Minister Noda ruining the country or whatever.
Right.
And people think they're being interesting and intelligent, just kind of raising these kind of discussions and wanting to have these discussions with Japanese people. But, yeah, that politics with really, really good friends and in a context where it's understood that offense isn't to be taken or that you're being genuinely interested is okay. But the context in which you can talk about, and religion as well, like in terms of, I think people happily say, you know, like the standard Japanese, you know, are like, sometimes they go to Shinto shrines, sometimes they go to Teras or whatever.
Right.
But when you start talking about specific religious sects, like, you know, like Sokogakai or like, you know, Toitsu Kyokai, like the Moonies, or the thing is that there are some of these religious groups in Japan, and the Buddhist groups are very, very, very large.
Right.
And yeah, you just can't talk negatively or basically any way about those in my experience. If you broach it the wrong way, and what will always happen is if you say something like those, you know, damn LDP, that used to be the old one, of course, until they actually finally got voted out recently.
Right.
But for various reasons that, you know, go back into the history, the post-war history of Japan, people from that generation where, you know, Japan was like in a state of civil war over politics during the 60s and 70s.
Right.
If you to say something negative about the LDP to someone from that generation makes you sound like you're a member of the Red Brigades,
right.
The Red Army or something like that. Like they'll literally like shut down. They won't tell you anything, but they'll just stop talking to you. They'll kind of shun you.
Right.
And same with religion. I've put my foot in it talking about. I read a book about Sokogakai, and I went into my work and I said, "Hey, I heard all this crazy stuff about Sokogakai," and I found out later that two or three people at my work were from it. And those people all stop talking to me after I just said that one thing.
Oh, wow, really?
And they never come and confront you about it. They'll never say anything about it. But, you know, you always have to presume that someone's going to be deeply offended by bringing up those topics. You know, you have to really only bring them up if it's totally clear in advance and it's okay.
Right.
So this is it, where you can kind of talk. And this whole idea of parody or, you know, being satirical about politics or something like The Daily Show, for example.
Yeah.
In terms of, or the Brits do the same thing a lot with religion as well, like being kind of, you know, making fun of Catholic priests or making fun of, you know, Republicans or whatever. There's just no culture for that kind of for that kind of comedy or that kind of humor in Japan.
And really, there's no political satirism, no political commentary, cartoons, anything like that.
I mean, if you look at
the bulk of American comedy.
yeah, and most of it just goes down like cold vomit in Japan. It just doesn't relate. People just get so easily offended by that kind of discussion.
Wow,
you do see it if you look on the Japanese 2-channel related sites.
Right,
there are threads and some really really good ones. I often post links on Twitter from a site called Itai News, which takes kind of. Basically ridiculous kind of news stories, or kind of like, you know, oh, I can't, it's like The Daily Show. They'll pick this, oh, I can't believe they said that, I can't believe this guy did this, and all it has all the comments below, and people actually do make really, you know, they're political topics, and people do make funny, I mean, really laugh out loud, great jokes and gags in response to the stories. But the thing about Nichan, or 2chan, is that it's, of course, completely anonymous.
Right, right.
So it's because it's completely anonymous that you actually have this very strong, particularly right-wing. There's leftists as well, but it's mainly right-wing, very, very political people and very heavy political debate on that site. But this is it. You could be sitting next to someone who's always posting, you know, Koreans all get out of Japan now, you know, on 2chan, and be totally like, you'd have no idea if you're sitting next to him at work.
Okay, so let's switch away from politics then. before both of our channels get banned. But actually, I wanted to talk to you about kind of the gaijin experience here in Japan.
Yeah.
A good friend of ours, Ren, recently posted a video talking about the Napoleon complex that she sees many gaijin have.
Right.
And the Napoleon complex is, you know, this kind of superiority that you feel you have within your little Japanese world here in Japan, and how when another foreigner invades that, it's not always the most positive thing. And also too is how many foreigners here struggle with this ideology that they need to be fully accepted into Japanese culture.
Yeah.
And the video that you, response that you posted, which I thought was so interesting, was do they really want to be accepted into Japanese culture? Because being a Japanese here is can be really difficult.
Exactly. For starters, I mean, a lot of the people who willingly go into small country towns or go into a, you know, deeply, deeply immersed, no other foreigners around environments, you know, they do this to kind of obviously improve their Japanese, but also, you know, everyone's trying to have this kind of, you know, very deep and unique experience of Japan. Everyone's trying to be like the Daniel-san from, you know, from Karate Kid. And I was one of them. I mean, I totally admit, I was a complete, I mean, I reflect now on being a complete dick. I was one of these guys who, you know, I would see some, you know, some annoying, you know, a group of Americans come up and say, hey, man, where's our McDonald's? And I would, like, you know, leave me alone. I wouldn't talk back to them or say something like that, which I totally am not like now. But there are a lot of people who, you know, take their experience of Japan very seriously. But, and it's this kind of catch-22, because it's exactly like you said, the people who choose to have those kind of experiences often put themselves in situations where they are the only foreigner in the town, and as a result of that, they stand out like a sore thumb, and they become known as the foreigner in the town. So this was a case that another vlogger called Bobby Judo faced in Saga, which is one of the most remote prefectures in Japan, which I'm kind of familiar with as well. And I know, for I've been to Saga, and I know if you're the only foreigner in your town in Saga, you know, you'll be 85 years old, you'll have lived there, you know, 70 years, and you're going to still be the foreigner in the town. I mean, frankly, I mean, you could be from Tokyo in Saga, and you'll be like the guy from Tokyo in the town until you die.
Really?
I mean, it's just the kind of place that it is. But there are these people, there's this question which always comes up after about a year when you hit that first real depression, you know, this kind of realization that hits a lot of people after about a year of trying really hard to be Japanese in Japan. It's the realization that, you know, my Japanese is up to speed, I'm now living a relatively normal life, I'm speaking Japanese, I'm working in Japanese, you know, I've got a position in whatever company I work at in this town, I know all the people, but they're still treating me like the new guy, like the guest. And people, this thing is, all this hard work that I'm doing to be treated like everyone else, is this a waste of time? Am I going to be treated like a guest forever? So that was a question that he posed, and the answer which I posed, which comes from my experience of doing that, but doing that within Tokyo, and it is kind of different. In Tokyo and Osaka, I think, especially in Tokyo, there are enough foreigners here now that, and this is very different to even when I first arrived in 1999 and the 90s now. Now there's really a critical mass of foreigners here that foreigners really don't get a second look in Tokyo.
Right.
And it's why I suspect a lot of these foreigners in these small country towns actually really don't want to go to Tokyo, because they're not special anymore.
Right.
In Tokyo, people don't treat them like the kind of movie stars. It's kind of tough, because, you know, this is a thing. They don't, they, at the same time as resenting all the attention they get for being a foreigner, it's also overwhelmingly positive attention.
Right. They secretly like it.
They do. I mean, I liked it.
Yeah.
Again, I'll be happy to admit it. I love being a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, 15-year-old movie star in Fukuoka.
Right.
And I kind of was, I must admit, it was a real adjustment to come to Tokyo, where, like, people, you know, you ask someone for directions, and in Fukuoka, like, 10 people dive at you. At least this is what it was like in 1995. Whereas in Tokyo, you know, people, like, you know, just shoulder charge you, and, you know, nobody will stop and say anything. People just bump you out of the way. So there is that. So for me, what I found after spending a long time on this and working really as the only foreigner in this very big and very high-pressure Japanese company that I was in, and working very hard to get my Japanese and my professional abilities to a point that I was doing everything to a point where I was being assessed and treated and advanced as a Japanese person within the firm, that's when I started to realize how tough it is for the regular Japanese people, like in Japanese companies. You know, the kind of expectations of, you know, doing anything that your boss tells you to do kind of unquestioningly, like the kind of junior-senior, the senpai-kohai relationship aspect.
Right.
You know, the going out to the drinking sessions, the fact that you're not really supposed to have any kind of a life outside of your work. It was kind of going to Australia for the first time after being in Japan nonstop for 3 years that really kind of woke me up it made me realize that I was working very hard, and I'd gotten to a point where I was being accepted, and I was doing everything that I was supposed to do as a Japanese person. And I have other friends who have even gone further and gone on to become managers within Japanese organizations, and they've done that by you know, really going the extra yard to be fully accepted. But the extra yard is really basically, you know, acting Japanese and kind of sacrificing those kind of values that I brought with me from New Zealand or Australia. And so, yeah, I made this very long video, like, addressing him, telling him, you know, contrary to what a lot of people say, you can be here for a long time and you'll never be accepted as Japanese, which isn't true. I think it's true in places like Saga, and it's true in a lot of environments, but in a place like Tokyo, in a big Japanese company, depending on the people there, it is possible to be accepted like a normal Japanese. But the conclusion that I came to after going through that process for a long time and losing a lot of hair and weight.
You and had hair at one that, point?
I did have hair. I used to have a lot of blonde hair. It was fantastic.
When you first arrived in Japan.
I cycle faster now. You know, it's but I made all those sacrifices. But the conclusion I came to was, you know, the payoff for being Japanese, it's like... someone put it once to me like this: it's like winning a pie eating contest where the prize is that you have to eat more pie.
Right,
you
know? Right.
You know, it's a lot of sacrifice and hard work where the reward is that your expectation is that you'll do more hard work.
Right, right.
And you'll just do that until you retire and die. So, you know, for me, it's striking that balance ended up being the goal in time.
Where do you think, like, I've seen this in many countries that I've lived in as an expat, is that it seems like there's this kind of ongoing debate about, you know, whether you can ever be accepted or not. And what I don't understand is where that comes from. I wouldn't want to, you know, I'm half Japanese, and I've always told people that if I was 100% Japanese, I personally wouldn't live here. Because it seems, from what I see, it's a rather difficult life.
Well,
I like being half. I don't want to be fully accepted.
What I had, I can tell you this from my personal experience, so I'm sure this is similar to what a lot of other people feel. There's this feeling that somehow breaking through and reaching that point of acceptance in the Japanese population, somehow you're going to have this kind of Zen moment of understanding of everything, and, you know, somehow everything's going to be better.
Right.
And this is the realization that took me about a year of working in a Japanese company to realize that there is no Zen moment that comes.
Right.
You know, it just goes on like this forever. It's just struggle and struggle and struggle. And exactly. So this is the thing. I mean, you have Japanese family and you've lived in Japan as a kid, so you're actually familiar with what it is to be a Japanese person. And there's a lot of Japanese people that have grown up in Japan that don't want to be Japanese people, like ordinary Japanese people who migrate abroad. There's this whole idea that everything here is kind of, the more you look at stuff, the more mysterious it kind of is, and the more you want to figure it out.
Right.
And I guess there is this hope amongst people that figuring it all out will make everything better. And it's interesting to figure it out, and I still love that challenge and that process, and that's still what I've been doing for 13 years. It's just, you know, every little thing. I love how everything's just different and unique here in its own way, as it is in every other country. But, you know, how in Japan, you've got a country that looks very modern, but at the same time is very different to other modern countries.
I always find it funny that you know, people leave their own country, their home country, where they're 100% accepted. They understand everything. They come to a foreign country and then complain that they're not being accepted. You know, and my thing is, embrace your difference. You're an expat. I mean,
absolutely.
Isn't the whole point of moving to another country to see it from a different point of view?
Well, there's two other big things. One, the concept of acceptance. You have to realize that, as I'm sure you do, with Japanese people, even Japanese people are only accepted in the way that we consider being accepted, really only by a very small group of people themselves. Japanese
right.
keep a very small circle of muchi, or basically close family, high school friends. You know, of people that they're basically completely open with in their lives.
Right.
Japanese are not open with, you know, coworkers unless they're good friends or equivalent, you know, age or whatever. But if they're a different level at work or someone else at work, or, you know, anything from that out in remoteness, you know, they're very closed off within the society to other people.
Right.
And so that's kind of different in terms of Japanese tend to keep much smaller, much tighter social groups, I think, than in a lot of Western countries. And the other thing. The other thing, which I guess is a bit of a mind screw for a lot of people, especially coming from places like Canada and America and New Zealand and Australia, kind of New World countries, is that we have this kind of idea, again, that this universal idea that it's wrong to presume, like, multiculturalism is kind of a universal correct thing. You know what I mean? Like the idea to be kind of protective of one culture and exclusive towards other cultures, exclusionary towards other cultures, is somehow inherently wrong. And this as well, I mean, with Japan, Japan's not like that. You know, Japan takes foreign culture as it wants to, and you know, it's selective about immigration. And if you're a foreigner, if you look like a foreigner in a crowd of Japanese people are going to say you're a foreigner, and people react to that like, oh, that's racist. But you know, the fact is that our values were developed like that in order for us to take those countries away from the people who lived there originally.
Right.
Right? I mean, you know, the indigenous Canadians and the indigenous New Zealanders never signed off on multiculturalism.
Right, yeah. Ask them how they feel about that.
So this whole idea that it's because Japan wasn't colonized that, you know, they didn't sign off on multiculturalism, because why would you if it's your own country and you know, you're not being, there's no need to. So, you know, I mean, I think Japan still is coming around slowly on internationalization and on multiculturalism, and Tokyo is becoming, you know, much more cosmopolitan over time than it has been. But I don't think we can impose those kind of, and those expectations that we have, that we presume are these universal rights that make everything feel like, you know, oh, I'm there, look at me this way just because I'm a foreigner. And, you know, you shouldn't look at people like that. But we only think that way because we stole our countries.
Right.
So it's kind of, you know, the point is you have to learn to look at everything from both sides. And that's the process that's what's really changed me the most about living in Japan. Some will say, well, that makes you an apologist, which it does to some extent. But it means that you can discuss with all sides of people, you know, like, you know, it means when you can understand the issues from all sides, you're much closer to finding solutions and to be able to talk constructively.
Right. Yeah, it's the foreigners, that the ones that I can't stand the most are the ones who've been in a country a long time and they still perceive every slight or everything against them because they're a foreigner.
Racism.
Right, you know, like...
I don't realize that, like, honestly, like, well, and especially for Caucasians, I mean, it has to be said, I mean... Caucasians get a really, really good time here, and you know, 99% right. of the discrimination, and there is discrimination which you will get as a Caucasian, and it's completely positive. I mean, Japanese treat Caucasians better than they treat each other.
Right.
and for them to be complaining, like, it pisses off a lot of Japanese people that Caucasians complain, because they know, and Japanese people know, that you know they are better off than a lot of other foreigners and even most other Japanese. In a lot of ways here.
If people want to check out more about your channel, they can do a search for Hiko Simon on YouTube. And you also have a blog, Hiko Blog.
I have a blog, which, by the way, I just yesterday registered. I finally went, I put the money down, I registered the hikosimon.com domain.
Excellent.
So my blog is now on www.hikosimon, which is hikosaemon.com.
Excellent. And I'll link to all that from my website. And thanks, Hiko. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you about Japanese culture.
Yeah, me too. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks again to Hiko Simon for coming on the show. If you're interested in checking out his videos, do a search on YouTube for Hiko Simon. And the particular video that we were talking about is titled, It Ain't Easy Being Japanese. And it's Hiko's thoughts about, you know, being a Japanese in Japan and this kind of weird struggle that many foreigners have with wanting to be accepted as a Japanese. It's really a fascinating look at what life is like here in Japan, and so I highly recommend checking it out. This week is Golden Week here in Japan, and it's the biggest holiday in Japan. Everyone takes the whole week off and, you know, usually goes to their hometown to see their friends and family. And as a result, there's people will be taking trains all over the country. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk to a gentleman who's quite knowledgeable about the train system here in Japan. Mr. Christopher Hood will be joining me next week to talk about his book, titled Shinkansen, From Bullet Train to Symbol of Modern Japan. And it's all about the history of the Shinkansen and how it was developed and how it helped Japan develop and what he sees for the future of high-speed rail in Japan. So if you're into trains and kind of technology, join me next week for that. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm happy to be back in Japan and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.